picture this for a second, all right? You are standing on the Florida coast next month, April 2026.
Right, coming up fast.
Exactly. And you are watching humanity finally head back to the moon.
It's just wild to even say that out loud.
It really is. And, you know, when you picture a moment like that, like the absolute pinnacle of human spaceflight, you probably imagine this incredibly sleek, purely 21st century endeavor.
Oh, for sure. You picture a rocket where every single bolt and sensor was, you know, designed from scratch yesterday.
Right. Gleaming, representing the bleeding edge of modern science. But, and this is the hook here, what if I told you that this futuristic mission has a really fascinating, almost paradoxical twist to it? To get back to the moon, we are actually relying heavily on hardware physically built back in the 1980s.
Yeah, it's wild.
And we're trusting the lives of astronauts to chemical formulas that date all the way back to the early 1900s.
It really is a remarkable contradiction when you look closely at the engineering. I mean, we are taking our biggest leap forward in half a century. But to make that leap, we are quite literally standing on the shoulders of legacy technology.
Exactly. And that is what we are going to unpack today. So we're going to explore the brilliant engineering, the eye-watering financial costs, and this heavy reliance on heritage hardware.
Right. And to just set the scene for you, to give you a sense of the timeline, we are looking at launch windows for Artemis II opening as early as April 1st, 2026.
So practically tomorrow in aerospace terms.
Pretty much. And the mission duration is going to be roughly 10 days. Now, if you followed the Artemis 1 flight a few years ago.
Which was an unmanned test flight, right?
Yeah. Exactly. Artemis II changes the game entirely because, well, it's carrying a crew. Four astronauts will be riding inside the newly minted Orion capsule.
Specifically, I think it's officially designated as CM-003.
Yep, CM-003. But the crew gave it a much better nickname, Integrity.
I love that name, Integrity. And a crucial thing for you to understand about this specific mission profile is that they aren't actually landing on the lunar surface this time.
Right, no boots on the ground just yet.
Yeah, they are launching, traveling hundreds of thousands of miles to the moon, orbiting around it, and coming straight back in just 10 days.
It is a profoundly tight timeline for a journey of that distance.
A 10-day celestial ballet, basically. And, you know, I also just find myself marveling at the shift in nomenclature. Apollo was the 20th century moon program.
The ingenuity of the 60s and 70s.
Right. And Artemis is the sister of Apollo in Greek mythology, which is so fitting. This is our 21st century program. It acts as this vital bridge, you know. We return to the moon so we can eventually get humans all the way to Mars.
Exactly the plan.
But before we talk about how this towering rocket actually gets off the launch pad, I want to talk about coming home. Because the most terrifying, complex part of this journey isn't the launch.
Oh, absolutely not. It's the return.
Right. Re-entry.
Yeah, re-entry is where the physics of spaceflight just become incredibly unforgiving. When the Orion capsule returns from the moon, it hits the Earth's atmosphere, traveling at roughly 27,000 miles per hour.
Which is just a speed I can't even comprehend.
It's staggering. And when you are moving that fast, the friction from the atmosphere creates a wall of heat so intense it can literally vaporize metal.
Wow.
So to bleed off all that speed before the parachutes can safely deploy, NASA uses a maneuver they tested on Artemis 1. It's called a skip reentry.
Now, Lockheed Martin, the manufacturer, they like to compare this to skipping a stone across a pond, right?
Right. You throw the stone, it hits the water, bounces back up, and comes back down.
Which is a great visual. But to really understand the physics, it's more like taking a race car that has lost its brakes and intentionally sideswiping a gravel pit.
That's a much more violent but accurate way to put it.
Yeah. The spacecraft dips violently into the upper atmosphere, uses that extreme friction to slow down, and then basically bounces back out into the thinner atmosphere to cool off.
Just for a moment, yeah, before dipping back in for the final descent. It's an ingenious way to control speed.
It is. But here is where I have to push back on this whole state-of-the-art narrative.
Okay, let's hear it.
If Orion is a cutting-edge capsule, why did the post-flight inspection of Artemis 1 show that the heat shield's thermal blocks had charred, cracked, and physically shed pieces into the atmosphere?
Yeah, that's the million-dollar question from the report. And what's fascinating is that the root of that cracking wasn't a failure of modern engineering.
It wasn't.
No, it was actually a miscalculation regarding some very old material science. So to understand why it cracked, we have to look at what the shield is made of. It relies on a material system called AFCOAT.
Which is a heritage technology, right?
Exactly. It was developed and used during the Apollo program. And the specific resin binding that AFCOAT together, a material called Novolac, has been around since the early 1900s.
Wait, let me just pause right there so we can appreciate this.
Yeah.
We are protecting 21st century astronauts.
Mm-hmm.
Hitting the atmosphere at 27,000 miles per hour with a chemical resin invented before commercial airplanes even existed.
We are. And we're doing it because, historically, it works beautifully. Ablative heat shields are designed to slowly burn away, taking the heat with them.
Right.
Before Artemis 1, NASA tested this Avcoat and Novolac combination extensively on the ground, but those tests focused on extreme continuous heating.
So they just wanted to make sure it wouldn't melt all the way through.
Right. What the models failed to anticipate was how that century-old resin would react to the cooling fuses of that new skip maneuver we talked about.
Okay. So the problem wasn't the heat itself. It was what happens when you suddenly take the heat away.
Precisely. Let's look at the thermodynamics. Materials naturally expand when they get hot, right? And they contract when they cool down. During the skip, the capsule hits the atmosphere, gets incredibly hot, and the outer layer hardens and chars.
While the inside is still baking.
Exactly. The inner layers are still baking and releasing gases. But then the capsule skips back out into the thin, cold atmosphere. That outer charred layer cools rapidly.
Oh, wow. Meanwhile, the gases underneath are still hot and trying to expand.
You got it. It's classic thermal shock.
It reminds me of like when you take a hot glass baking dish out of the oven and accidentally put it on a cold, wet counter.
Yes. Perfect analogy.
The temperature differential causes the material to fight itself, and it shatters. Here, you have expanding trapped gases pushing against a rapidly cooling outer shell.
Exactly. That internal gas pressure had nowhere to go, so it pushed outward with enough force to pop pieces of the shield right off.
But the crew cabin would have been fine.
Oh, yeah. The interior stayed perfectly safe and cool, but the material behaved in this chaotic way that computer models just didn't predict.
So what does this mean for the four astronauts boarding Artemis 2 next month? Mm. I mean, did NASA completely redesign the heat shield?
They didn't. And this highlights a really interesting reality of aerospace engineering. When you're dealing with multi-billion dollar hardware that's already built,
you can't just scrap and start over.
Right. So for Artemis 2, they didn't change the physical hardware design. Instead, they changed the software and the flight path.
Wait, they just changed the trajectory?
Yep. They modified the re-entry to a much steeper angle.
Why a steeper angle?
Because a steeper angle means the capsule punches through the atmosphere more directly. It significantly reduces the time it spends in that intermediate cooling phase.
Oh. So if you minimize the cooling phase, you don't give the outer layer time to cool and trap those expanding gases.
Spot on. It's an elegant, physics-based software fix for a physical hardware limitation. They'll introduce new manufacturing techniques to prevent the gas buildup, but not until Artemis 3.
That is just wild to me. The fix is essentially, let's fly the spaceship at a slightly different angle, so the 1900s resin doesn't get thermally confused.
It's very pragmatic.
Extremely. Okay, but the heat shield isn't the only piece of the past hitching a ride here.
Not at all.
If the capsule relies on Apollo materials, what exactly is providing the millions of pounds of thrust to get this towering machine off the ground?
Well, for that, we look at the core stage of the Space Launch System, the SLS rocket. The bottom of that enormous orange stage is powered by four RS-25 engines.
Right.
And we need to be incredibly precise here about heritage hardware. These are not newly manufactured engines inspired by the space shuttle. They literally are space shuttle engines.
I want to make sure we get this history exactly right. I had to read this section twice.
It's a double take moment for sure.
One of the four engines that power that Artemis 1 rocket was designated Engine E-2045.
That's correct.
And that specific engine originally flew to space on the space shuttle Discovery in August of 1984.
Yep. Engine E-2045 was a seasoned veteran long before it helped push Artemis 1 toward the moon.
That is just wow.
It had already been to low Earth orbit and back multiple times during the shuttle era. I mean, to put 1984 in perspective, that was the year the first Apple Macintosh computer came out.
That is the perfect context. We are talking about engines built when computers still had green text on black screens.
Exactly.
And it's not just one isolated antique either. The report notes that the quote-unquote newest engine in the legacy rotation engine E-2062 isn't exactly fresh off the assembly line.
No, E-2062 was actually cobbled together from spare parts of older engines and officially recertified for flight back in 2017.
So you have four astronauts boarding a rocket in 2026, and they are literally riding on top of controlled explosions generated by engines older than many of the engineers in mission control.
It's true. We're talking about combustion chambers built 40 years ago.
Is this basically the aerospace equivalent of strapping astronauts into a beautifully restored classic car and telling them to win the Indy 500?
Well, it's a tempting analogy, but we do need to give credit to the refurbishment process. You weren't just pulling a classic car out of a garage and hitting the gas.
Fair point.
These engines have been meticulously disassembled, heavily inspected with modern non-destructive testing, and crucially upgraded with state-of-the-art computer controllers.
So they're smarter now.
Right. They operate at higher performance levels than they ever did on the shuttle. But your underlying point is completely valid. The physical plumbing is decades old.
It's astonishing that metal fatigue alone isn't a deal breaker. But NASA doesn't plan to use these antiques forever, right? What happens when we run out of old shuttle engines?
They have a transition plan. A company called L3 Harris is contracted to manufacture 24 brand new engines known as the E5 series.
Okay, so new hardware is coming.
It is. The current legacy ones are the E2 series. But developing a rocket engine from scratch takes immense time. Those new E5 engines won't debut until the Artemis 5 mission.
Artemis 5. So until then, our entire lunar ambition relies completely on the space shuttle's legacy.
100%.
Okay, let's pause and summarize what is sitting on that launch pad. We have a brand new Orion capsule.
Right.
Utilizing a 1900s resin to survive thermal shock. Sitting on an SLS rocket powered by 1980s space shuttle engines.
It's an incredible hybrid of old and new.
But that leads us to a glaring question. What happens to these historical artifacts once the rocket is actually in the air? Because this is easily the most controversial design choice of the entire program.
Oh, absolutely. It represents a total paradigm shift away from the space shuttle era. For 30 years, reusability was the core philosophy.
Right. The space plane landed on a runway.
And those RS-25 engines were meticulously cleaned and reused for dozens of flights. Even the solid rocket boosters, the SRBs, would deploy parachutes and splash into the ocean.
And NASA had ships that would just sail out and tow them back, right?
Exactly. It was an industrial-scale recycling program for rocket parts. But on Artemis, every single piece of that propulsion hardware is permanently thrown away.
Let's break down the cost. Those heritage RS-25 engines, estimated value of roughly $100 million apiece.
And the core stage uses four of them.
So that is $400 million in engines that push the capsule to space, fall back into the atmosphere, and intentionally burn up.
Just completely destroyed. And that's just the core stage. You have to factor in the solid rocket boosters, too.
Right. And these Artemis boosters aren't exactly the shuttle ones. They are upgraded from the canceled Constellation and Ares programs from the 2000s.
Right. Engineers lengthened the old shuttle design and made them more powerful to handle the SLS's weight.
And independent estimates put these new towering boosters at roughly $200 to $300 million each.
Yep. And 2 minutes after liftoff, they exhaust their fuel, detach, and fall into the ocean.
No parachutes.
No parachutes. They just sink to the bottom, never recovered.
So combining the four core engines and the two boosters, NASA is discarding roughly $1 billion in propulsion hardware during every single launch.
$1 billion, yeah. And to put that in perspective, a 2021 estimate from NASA's Inspector General placed the total cost of a single Artemis launch at about $4.1 billion.
So a quarter of the entire mission cost is just dropped in the ocean or burned up minutes after ignition.
Pretty much.
I have to play devil's advocate here. If you were listening to this right now, you're probably scratching your head.
I don't blame them.
We live in an era where commercial spaceflight companies are doing the exact opposite. SpaceX is landing rocket boosters on drone ships every week.
Specifically so they can hose them off and fly them again.
Exactly. So why on earth is NASA intentionally throwing away $1 billion of towering hardware in an era obsessed with recycling?
It looks completely backwards if you only look at the financial sheet. But to understand the engineering logic, we have to talk about a concept known as the tyranny of the rocket equation.
Oh, I love that phrase. The tyranny of the rocket equation. Let me try to break this down because the concept is fascinating.
Go for it.
It essentially highlights a brutal mathematical reality. Every single pound of payload you take to space requires a certain amount of fuel to lift it.
Right.
But fuel has weight. So when you add fuel, your rocket becomes heavier, which means you now need to add even more fuel just to lift the extra fuel you just added.
It's a vicious cycle of diminishing returns.
Like packing your car for a road trip, but every time you add a gallon of gas, the car magically gets 100 pounds heavier.
That is a perfect way to visualize it. Now apply that tyrannical math to reusability. If you want to safely recover a booster, you can't just let it fall.
You have to attach giant, heavy parachutes.
Right. tracking beacons. Yeah. You have to heavily reinforce the metal so it doesn't crumple when it hits the water. All of that adds thousands of pounds of dead weight.
And in the context of the rocket equation, weight is the ultimate enemy of performance.
Precisely. By intentionally removing the parachutes and retrieval systems, NASA engineers opted for pure, unadulterated simplicity to enhance immediate performance.
So because that weight is gone, the rocket can dedicate all its energy to pushing the heavy Orion capsule toward the moon.
Exactly. Jim Free, who was NASA's associate administrator before retiring in 2025, addressed this directly. He said, "The architecture we've chosen doesn't allow for reusability. Disposing of it is the best way to go."
Wow. So it's not institutional amnesia. NASA didn't forget how to reuse things. They actively, mathematically chose not to.
They had to squeeze every ounce of thrust out of that rocket. And the only way to do that was to throw the engines away.
It makes perfect sense from a physics standpoint, but financially, knowing $1 billion of perfectly good heritage hardware is sinking to the bottom of the ocean, that is a tough pill to swallow.
It's a profound trade-off. By choosing expendability, NASA saves the massive ongoing costs of maintaining a recovery fleet.
No ships, no saltwater refurbishment infrastructure.
Right, but the flip side is incurring the steep cost of building brand new hardware from scratch every time. For Artemis, expendability was simply the more viable performance path.
It really reframes how you look at this upcoming launch. When you see that rocket clear the tower, you aren't just seeing a vehicle, you're seeing $1 billion of deliberate sacrifices made in the name of physics.
That's exactly what it is.
So what does this all mean for us as we look toward April 2026? Let's bring all these threads together. Artemis II is undeniably a thrilling step.
A huge milestone.
We are sending humans back to the moon's vicinity and laying the groundwork for Mars.
But uniquely built on the physical shoulders of Apollo and the shuttle.
Right. A brilliant new capsule, relying on a century-old resin to survive the fiery return. An expendable rocket that intentionally burns up decades-old flight-proven shuttle engines.
It's a deeply pragmatic approach. They looked at the monumental task and used what they knew worked, even if it meant permanently sacrificing that history.
And I think that is the big takeaway for you listening right now. We so often assume that progress requires building everything entirely from scratch.
A blank slate.
Yeah, full of shiny new inventions. But in reality, rocket science often means repurposing the reliable, proven tools of the past to push the boundaries of the future. The hardware may be legacy, but the destination is entirely new.
And, you know, that inherent tension leaves us with a critical and maybe slightly unsettling question to consider long after this deep dive ends.
What's that?
Well, we talked about how the new E5 engines won't be ready until Artemis 5. Until then, we are burning up a finite supply of vintage 1980s engines.
Right. We only have so many left in the warehouse.
Exactly. So if we are completely dependent on these limited leftover parts, what happens if the development of those new engines gets severely delayed?
Oh, wow.
Are we unknowingly putting ourselves in a position where we are just one broken vintage part or one supply chain bottleneck away from grounding humanity's return to the moon entirely?
Could our reliance on the reliable tools of the past mean we literally run out of history before the future is ready to take over?